From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Art of Conducting, we talk with Benjamin Zander, conductor of the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra. He's known for his passionate interpretations of Mahler and for his ability to communicate the stories and ideas behind the music to his audiences. Zander has a new CD and a new book about the psychology of creativity. Also, British actress Brenda Blethyn. She's best known for her roles in Secrets and Lies, for which she was nominated for an Oscar, and Little Voice. Her film Saving Grace is out on video. This weekend, Blethyn co-stars in the ABC miniseries Anne Frank. And we conclude our series, Avant-Garde Made Easy, with the music of Misha Mengelberg. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel bombed Palestinian security areas today in retaliation for a suicide bombing that left at least five Israelis dead and dozens injured. Israel's attack killed at least 10 Palestinians. The BBC's John Lyon reports from Jerusalem.
In a confrontation that's been steadily deteriorating, this was the worst day of violence for a very long time. The bloodletting began when a Palestinian suicide bomber set off an explosion outside an Israeli shopping center in Netanya, causing terrible devastation. Within hours, the Israelis launched their retaliation. They used warplanes for the first time in the recent conflict, the weapon deliberately chosen to send the toughest possible message to the Palestinians. The retaliation had been widely expected, but the scale of the casualties and the use of F-16 fighter jets marked a significant escalation of the conflict.
The BBC's John Lyon in Jerusalem. A Utah man being tried on polygamy charges testified today that he doesn't consider himself to be legally married to any of his five wives. Tom Green says that as far as the government is concerned, he's single. As far as God is concerned, Green said he considered himself married. And the 52-year-old faces four counts of bigamy and one count of criminal failure to pay child support. Green's case could go to a jury today in Provo, Utah. President Bush marked Cuban Independence Day by vowing to continue economic sanctions against Havana until Cuba frees political prisoners and allows free speech and democratic elections. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The effectiveness of unilateral sanctions is coming in for increased debate on Capitol Hill. But at a White House ceremony attended by Cuban-American politicians and celebrities, the president vowed to oppose efforts to soften the sanctions.
I will fight such attempts until this regime frees its political prisoners, holds democratic free elections, and allows for free speech. The policy of our government is not merely to isolate Castro, but to actively support those working to bring about democratic change in Cuba.
The president drew applause when he called on Fidel Castro to stop jamming U.S. broadcasts of radio and television Martí. The ceremony marks the day in 1902 that the U.S. granted Cuba its independence. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. trade deficit widened sharply in March, posting the biggest monthly gain in at least 9 years. The Commerce Department said Americans' demand for foreign goods boosted the trade gap by 16%. At the same time, American exports to other countries declined by about 1%. The U.S. trade deficit with Mexico hit an all-time high. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 53 points to close at 11,301 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 5 points to finish at 2,198. This is NPR News. A man convicted of assaulting women in New York's Central Park last year has been sentenced to 5 years in prison. The attacks on more than 50 women occurred during the Puerto Rican Day parade last June. Abel Ortiz was the last of the defendants to be tried in the case, and he received the longest sentence. The judge in the case told Ortiz that videos taken at the time showed him encouraging the riot and directing men to where the women were. Women who testified at Ortiz's trial said they were soaked with water, their clothes were torn off, and they were groped by crowds of rioters. Firefighters near Orlando, Florida, are still working to contain a blaze burning near Walt Disney World. It's the latest wildfire to cause problems in Florida during a busy fire season. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
The Central Florida wildfire started off by burning about 175 acres about 4 miles from the Walt Disney World tourist complex. Since then, it's moved to about 2 miles from the parks, which include the Magic Kingdom and Epcot Center. There's been no evacuations at the 27,000-acre entertainment facility, but visitors are dealing with hazy skies. Two firefighting airplanes dropped chemicals to battle the blaze. Over 2,000 separate wildfires have burned in Florida since January, blackening over 180,000 acres. While Central Florida firefighters work on the Disney World blaze, Orange County bomb squad officials are trying to learn who left a pipe bomb near a shopping and dining complex called Pleasure Island at Disney. A tourist found the device, and that prompted the evacuation of a restaurant while the explosive was collected and detonated. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
As the government counted income tax receipts, the federal budget surplus in April burgeoned to a record of almost $190 billion. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Home Entertainment, presenting Quills, inspired by the writings of the Marquis de Sade, starring Jeffrey Rush and Kate Winslet, available to rent on VHS and own on DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Over his 20-year history with the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, Benjamin Zander has earned an international reputation as one of the most ambitious conductors in the business, daring to take on the great masters of the classical repertoire. He's known as an expert on the music of Gustav Mahler and has been working with the London Philharmonia since 1995, conducting and recording a series of the composer's symphonies. His new CD with the Philharmonia is a recording of Mahler's Fifth, and it includes an extra disc in which Zander explores the emotional dynamics of Mahler's music and the composer's tragic life. The discussion is drawn from Zander's popular pre-concert talks. Here's an excerpt.
Mahler's orchestra is huge, over 100 musicians, but it is rare for them to play all together, although when they do, you certainly know about it. Listen to this moment at the climax of the first movement, when all the musicians on stage are playing as loud as they possibly can. And in order to be sure he gets the very loudest sound possible, Mahler marks an instruction for each of the wind and brass players to raise the bells of their instruments into the air. It is an overwhelming sound. In an acoustically responsive concert hall, it can have a visceral effect analogous to being hit hard in the solar plexus. At home, it is the ultimate test not only of the range of your hi-fi equipment, but also of the human capacity to tolerate sheer decibels.
Benjamin Zander is the co-author of a new book about music and the psychology of creativity. It's called The Art of Possibility, Transforming Professional and Personal Life. I spoke with Zander last year after the release of his recording of Mahler's Ninth Symphony, which included a copy of Zander's own conducting score. I asked him why he wanted listeners to see his notes.
Well, there are two reasons. One is it's a fascinating way of entering a score, because otherwise how would an ordinary person be able to look at a score unless somebody were to guide them through it by pointing out everything that a conductor would need to know? There's another reason, which is that if you focus for a moment on every element in the music and realize that every note and every gesture and every shape and every phrasing means something in the whole, that gives you an insight how to listen. And that's my main purpose. I believe that every human being has the capacity to respond to great music and to be touched and moved by it and to have their lives changed by it. And so this is the best way of drawing people in, namely to say, listen to this note, and then listen to that, and then now listen to this, and see what this is doing while that's happening, and think about the meaning and the implication of that. And gradually, people get drawn in, and people have told me, people who've never had any training in music whatsoever, have told me they've been riveted by that experience, and they've used it as a way of getting inside the music and listening to the rest of the piece, since obviously I only do that for two pages, to listen to the rest of the piece with their eyes and ears wide open.
Do you think that it's similar to what people say about poetry, that as children we have this innate ability to interact, to experience
the music, to feel it, and that we, yes, we lose that as we get older, unless you nourish it.
We lose it the way we lose all sorts of things in life. You know, you were a seven-year-old child and you were singing in a choir and the teacher said, don't actually sing, I'd prefer it if you would just mouth the words because you're spoiling the sound of the choir. And that child grows up to be somebody who later on says, I'm tone deaf and can't hear music. And that's all it is. It's somebody simply closing down a door which used to be open. I feel my role is partly to open those doors again, to remind people of the power of this music and how deeply affecting it can be, even if you have no academic training in it or don't even really know the difference between, you know, a dominant seventh and a minor third. But somehow this music is, we are permeable to this music if we allow ourselves to be, and we close down all the conversations which tell us that we can't do it.
You have an interesting professional history with this music, with Mahler and Mahler's Ninth. I think over 20 years ago you were fired as the conductor of the Boston Civic Symphony by its board because you presented this symphony. You presented such difficult music. What so provoked them? What did they not like about it?
Well, I'd done a lot of, as they called it, mela. They didn't like the music. It was too difficult. You know, this was an orchestra that wanted to be entertained. One of the board members asked me why I didn't perform any of the Chopin symphonies. Well, of course, I said I had no time to write any. But this was not a group of people who wanted to be challenged to the ultimate. And so they saw this as a kind of confrontation. They fired me because they felt that the orchestra was going in the wrong direction. And what happened next was that the entire orchestra resigned, all 98 players. And I think the reason for that was because the players themselves saw this as a wonderful path to be going on, to be delving deep into this music. We had a long period of rehearsal time because it was a community orchestra. And so I believe we had 22 rehearsals for that performance over a three-month period. And it really transformed the lives of the people who participated. And they weren't about to give that up, so they went on with what is now the Boston Philharmonic.
Now, we've been talking about how difficult and complex this music is, and you do say in the discussion of Mahler's Ninth that, especially in this third movement of it, that you wonder why the first-time listener would want to listen. They might ask themselves, why should I listen to this? It's so bleak. It's so hard to follow. And that yes, you know someone who always leaves it out when he listens,
right,
to this symphony.
Well, it's the old recordings, you know, on the LPs, it was on four sides. And so he could conveniently go from the end of the first movement to the last movement, which is gorgeous and beautiful and very, very satisfying and to listen to. And he left out those middle two movements. And what I believe, of course, is that we have to go through the struggle of the middle movements to the dark night of the soul in order to appreciate coming out the other side, so that when we finally get to the pages at the end of the Ninth Symphony where he expresses his own mortality, his own death, we have been on a long, arduous struggle and come out the other side. If you have avoided the struggle, obviously you don't appreciate and don't experience the whole thing. That's the flaw with the approach to music, which we see so much nowadays, of taking little bits, the sort of the best moments of an opera or the best moments of a symphony, and pretending that that is the work.
Let's listen then to the third movement of Mahler's Ninth. And Ben, would you like to say anything before we listen,
well,
to music?
Well, the thing about this movement is that it's enormously complex. This is about as complex as music can get in terms of polyphony, of the voices that are piled one on top of the other. In this, he's like Bach, and in fact, he was influenced by Bach. The tempo which I chose for this performance is a little bit slower than it's often heard, and the reason for that is in order to make sure that every single voice is clearly heard, so that the complexity of the language of every single moment is experienced. And when in the end it goes over the edge, it really goes into madness, into a complete hysteria at the end in the final section, that is then a feeling of going over a precipice, of having experienced everything and gone over the edge. Of course, the consolation of the final movement has to be experienced too in order to get the full weight of that. But it is a chilling, grim, forbidding experience, although so masterful in its expression and its technique that it blows one's mind.
Let's listen. This is the third movement of Mahler's Ninth. That's my guest, Benjamin Zander, leading the Philharmonia Orchestra of London in a live performance of Mahler's Ninth. Now, I want Ben to play a little bit of the final movement of this symphony, because as you said earlier, you want to get to the resolution.
The consolation
of the final movement. And the beginning, I find myself listening to this, holding my breath, waiting to exhale. Is that what you're consciously leading your orchestra to create that effect?
Definitely. I'm thrilled that you have that feeling. And actually, at the end of that movement, there's a 56-second silence before anybody dared to applaud after the performance. And that's the same thing you're talking about. Mahler has the capacity of holding us in thrall, where the lines are so long, where the tension is so great, that he simply doesn't allow us to breathe. And if we allow the music to unfold in that way, we can hold 2,000 people in a hall in that kind of spell. And it's one of the few things that can do that.
Let's listen to the fourth movement, the beginning of the fourth movement of Mahler's Ninth. That's my guest, Benjamin Zander, leading the Philharmonia Orchestra of London in a live performance of Mahler's Ninth. For this music, do you make a conscious effort to develop the individuality of your musicians rather than trying to homogenize the sound of the orchestra?
Yes, that gets at the absolute central idea of Mahler's music. In most music, we're taught to make all the voices amalgamate, as you say, homogenize. That's a perfect way of describing it, where everything is related and listening carefully to everything else, and it all sounds very pretty. The secret of Mahler's music is that every single individual voice is separate from every other, and that makes it profoundly modern. Each voice, each instrument, seems to have a life of its own. And sometimes he calls on an instrument to play very softly, and at the same time, another instrument might be playing very loud and raucously. And it's actually quite a discipline to get an orchestra to realize that and not make the quiet person play a little louder and the loud person a little softer to make it all belong together. And that is at the absolute core of his expression. And I think tells us something about who we are as people, and is a unique voice for Mahler.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Zander. He is the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic. He teaches at the New England Conservatory and conducts their Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. He's also served as guest conductor for numerous other orchestras in this country and abroad. Ben, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Boston Philharmonic conductor Benjamin Zander. Now, how do you decide as a conductor where to take liberties with a piece and to depart from the notations of a composer and when to adhere to them as faithfully as you can?
Well, I'm one who believes in adhering faithfully to what the composer wrote. And I will actually go to quite extremes to do that. I really believe these composers were taking us into often counterintuitive places, places where we wouldn't go just on our own naturally by following our instincts. And so I think it behooves us to follow exactly what they had in mind. And the Beethoven performances are based not only on following every dynamic marking and every phrasing, but also the tempi that he left through the metronome marks. And that makes them very unusual because most people have disregarded those tempo marks and say they're unreasonable or they're too fast or they don't work or whatever. I have taken him at his word, always asking the question, could he have meant it? Could he have meant it? So in general, I would say we follow religiously what the composer has given us. In some cases, I find myself changing what's there. And there would always have to be a very special reason why that I would do that.
Can you give us an example of when you would take a different path?
Well, I might take a different path if I simply cannot understand what the composer meant. The first movement of the Prokofiev Fifth Symphony is at a tempo so slow that I cannot make it work at that tempo. Now, there's something either I'm wrong about it or he simply wrote the wrong tempo. I think it's perfectly possible that either is true. That would be one example. There's a fascinating example in Stravinsky of The Rite of Spring, where what the composer wrote and what I believe he intended was something different. That happened because we have a piano roll of Stravinsky, not actually playing, but a piano roll he supervised of the final section, the Danse Sacrale, where the piano roll is 30 points faster on the metronome than his own performances and what he wrote in the score. And it's possible that the faster tempo, thrilling and exciting as it is, was simply too hard to play or too hard to conduct, and so he reduced the tempo so that it would be more comfortable. I think in the process, he lost some of the power and the incredible excitement of hearing this at a breakneck speed. This is, after all, suggesting a young virgin dancing herself to death. And at the slower tempo, I suspect she would hardly break a sweat. At the faster tempo, you can really feel the frenzy and the desperation and the terror. And I think it makes a much more effective interpretation, though Stravinsky himself neither did it nor wrote it.
Now, I know you brought two examples of the Rite of Spring with you so that we could hear this.
Yes.
Maybe we could play them.
Good. Well, you can hear, first of all, there's a performance of Stravinsky playing, say, the last minute of the Danse Sacrale at the tempo that he chose both to mark in the score and to perform it at. And then immediately afterwards, we could play the same passage played by the Boston Philharmonic at the tempo of the piano roll.
Thank you.
And now the Boston Philharmonic's recording from a live performance of the last minute of the Danse Sacrale. That's the Boston Philharmonic playing Stravinsky's Danse Sacrale from The Rite of Spring. Benjamin Zander is the co-author of a new book, The Art of Possibility. His new CD is Mahler Symphony No. 5, Benjamin Zander conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead concludes his Avant-Garde Made Easy series with the music of Misha Mengelberg. Also, actress Brenda Blethyn. She co-stars in the TV miniseries Anne Frank, which begins this weekend. Blethyn's films include Secrets and Lies, Little Voice, and Saving Grace, which was recently released on video. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. This Sunday night, ABC airs the first half of the new miniseries Anne Frank, based on Melissa Muller's 1998 biography. Brenda Blethyn plays Mrs. Van Pels, who, with her husband and son, also hides in the Frank's Annex. Blethyn is a British actress best known to audiences here in the States for her portrayals of single mothers, both in Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies, which won her an Oscar nomination, and the film Little Voice with Michael Caine. I spoke with Brenda Blethyn last year at the release of her feature film Saving Grace, directed by Nigel Cole, about a widow whose philandering husband leaves her monstrously in debt. Grace enters into a desperate scheme with her gardener Matthew to raise money by growing marijuana. Saving Grace is now out in video. Brenda Blethyn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Grace is a masterful gardener of all kinds of plants, and she ends up then growing these hundreds of kilos of marijuana, enough to fill a whole greenhouse. I understand you used actual hemp plants. Did that cause any problems with the law, or did you have to get a special dispensation to work with hemp?
Oh, yes, we did. Now, the marijuana plants, most of them, I hasten to add, are made by our expert design department, Eve Stewart, who you might know was Oscar-nominated for Topsy Turvy. But the ones in the foreground are actual hemp plants, and they were loaned to us under special dispensation from the Home Office, from the government, and they arrived under police escort and I think were locked up at night. However, the potent part of their plant had been removed, but I wouldn't know the difference from one from the other, but that's what I'm told anyway.
There's another great scene in the movie where you're posing as a drug dealer in London, and you're this wonderful upper middle class woman from this small town. You're wearing this brilliant white suit, this lovely get-up with an aviator scarf or something, and you're in the seedy neighborhood in London. Apparently,
yes.
You convinced passerbys rather too well while you were filming the scene.
Yes, I did. Oh, and by the way, she looked fabulous in that suit 25 years ago. It was part of her trousseau. It's a good job she hung on to it, but my goodness, I thought she looked like Dame Edna Everidge. I don't know if you've ever heard of
Absolutely.
Her.
Absolutely.
But yes, it was an improvised scene in a busy, normal shopping day in Portobello Road, and the cameras were hidden. And there was no way it could be choreographed. And so to facilitate that, I was introduced to 40 extras who I'd never seen before in my life before we started the scene. And they were all brilliantly dressed to blend in with normal everyday shoppers. Now, I don't know about you, Barbara, but if you were introduced to 40 strangers who then mingled in with hundreds of other strangers, would you remember which one was which? Because I couldn't.
I don't blame you.
And so inadvertently, I would go up to innocent shoppers and ask if they would like to buy my stash. and then I'd see Nigel waving his hand, shouting, "No, no, no, not that one, not that one." And I have to say, I scored twice. And one gentleman tried to make a citizen's arrest on me and put me in an arm lock. And Nigel had to come flying down again from his perch and say, "No, no, no, please put her down. It's Brenda Blethyn. She's in our film, Saving Grace. You'll love it when you see it." But he did laugh. He did see the funny side of it, the man did. But good for him.
You were nominated for an Oscar for your role as Cynthia in Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies. Cynthia is a bit of a down-and-out working-class single mom who, in the course of the mm-hmm. film, is reunited with a daughter she gave up for adoption when she was 15. Had you played many working-class women of Cynthia's sort when you were cast in the film?
I've certainly been offered a lot of working-class roles since playing Cynthia. Mostly at the theatre, I would play middle-class characters. But yes, I have played working-class before. Six of one, half a dozen of the other, really. Since I made Secrets and Lies, most of the scripts I received, film scripts, were for unfortunate women who cried a lot. But I didn't
think I could do a lot of that in the film.
Yes, she is such a sad lady. Mm.
Mike Leigh is well known for his ensemble style of producing a film. He casts actors he wants, and then you all develop the character through months and months of workshops. What did you know about your character, Cynthia, when you arrived for rehearsals the first day of Secrets and Lies?
I knew absolutely nothing about her. She didn't exist when I arrived. I invented her with Mike Lee. In fact, when you embark on an engagement with Mike Lee, you have absolutely no idea what sort of role you're going to be playing at all. I could have been playing a duchess for all I knew. Neither are we given a storyline. We know absolutely nothing. And that's not just at the beginning, that's throughout the engagement. I have to say, I didn't know fully what the film was about until I went to see it in the cinema. An actor's only responsibility is to the character they are creating and to any other character they might come into contact with. Obviously, I had seen a cast list. I didn't know everybody on the cast list, so I didn't get to meet a lot of them. And so when Cynthia goes to meet the daughter she gave up for adoption 27 years earlier, I had absolutely no idea whatsoever who was going to turn up, if anybody. It was a total shock.
Now, before, I want to talk about that scene where you meet your daughter, but before we do, I'm curious how you begin at the beginning to develop the character. Do you start in chronological order and start with the young backstory of a character named Cynthia?
Yeah, there is no backstory, but you are right. The character is created totally chronologically. And having found a starting point, and that could be anything at all, just one particular characteristic, her generosity, for instance. I don't think it was that, but that could be something. And then you start from the year dot. And then when you get to age four, after maybe 6 weeks or so, of working with Mike Lee, sort of discovering what this woman, you would build her history in the minutest of detail. For instance, what was the wallpaper like in her bedroom? What was the view from the window? What sounds would be coming from the kitchen? Who else would be in the house at that time of day? And this is from like age four. Would father have gone to work yet? What was the bed linen like? And all these things, so that when you progress, it's totally chronologically, the character is bringing a history with her.
Let's play the scene from Secrets and Lies in which Cynthia meets her daughter Hortense for the first time. And this is her daughter who she gave away at birth and never even held her, didn't ever see her.
That's right. Didn't see her.
They agree to talk in a tea room, coffee house. Cynthia doesn't believe Hortense is her daughter because Hortense is black.
They shouldn't go raising your hopes like that. It ain't fair.
Is this your signature?
This is stupid. I don't understand it. I mean, I can't be your mother, can I?
Why not?
Well, look at me.
What?
Listen, I don't mean nothing by it, darling, but I ain't never been with a black man in my life. No disrespect nor nothing. I'd have remembered, wouldn't I? Jesus Christ Almighty!
That's a scene from Secrets and Lies, which starred my guest Brenda Blethyn. So, and of course, in that pause in the clip, that's really your face doing the acting when you're suddenly remembering, I suppose, a one-night stand.
Yes. So that's what I mean, in that long pause when she's working it out. Because for 27 years, she thought the father was somebody else. A white man who she'd been working with all that time earlier. And so in that pause, she's working out what could have happened in that time. Who possibly could it have been? And then she remembers an incident in that pause that tells her that probably she is her daughter. But it was just the shock of it. But I have to channel all that through Cynthia's memory, not my own. Brenda thinks that'll probably get a laugh. you know. But that third eye up there watching what I'm doing, because it's not method acting, it's the opposite. You have to be totally objective about what we're doing all the time.
How then does Lee's technique stretch you as an actor, or change you as an actor?
Oh, well, I have to say, I worked with Mike Lee, first of all, on a film for the BBC called Grown Ups in 1980. And after working with him on that, I realised that everything I had done beforehand, I'd been really lazy on. And so I on everything I do now, on every scripted piece, well, I mean, mostly I do work on scripted work, I employ some of his technique. I have to work out a back history for the character. If the writer's around, I will consult with him. Or if he's not, I will. I have to know how the character arrives at page one. Where have they been until page one? For instance, in Saving Grace, I open up at page one and here she is in her mid-40s. So I read the script, I know what the script is, but how did she arrive at page one? What mood is she in at the top of page one? Did she have a good night's sleep? And I want to know where she's been for 45 years. And so it's important for me to work that out. I might not share it with anybody, but I need to know it for myself, to know what makes the woman tick.
Brenda Blethyn. Blethyn plays Mrs. Van Pels in the new ABC miniseries Anne Frank. Part one airs Sunday night at 9. We'll continue our conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with actress Brenda Blethyn. You played another working-class single mom in Little Voice with Jane Horrocks.
Yes.
This time it's more of the gin-swilling, tardy variety, Mari. Let's give people a taste of her. Here she is remembering her good times with Ray Say, a sleazy nightclub talent agent who wants to exploit Mari's daughter's singing talent. In this scene, she's talking to her friend Sadie in a tea room.
Sadie, what a night I had me last night, eh? What a friggin' championship night. You should have seen me. Queen for a night I was. You'll never guess who. Ray Say.
Ray friggin' Say. You know him. He's agent to the stars, king of cabaret, manager of miracles. He's down at Mr. Boo's nightclub all the time. Has that slight look of Elvis about him. You know him, everyone knows him. And he knows everyone. Ate it when Mr. Boo himself introduced us the other night. And 2 seconds said it, I fib you not. 2 seconds. And his hands on me ass, my golden old ass in Ray Say's hands. While he stands there telling jokes to Mr. Boo. Well, I saw him again last night. Oh, the music was in our heads, and in his wandering hands. He'll make it in anything, Ray Say. It's one of them lovable sort of types. Driving me round in his lovable mobile. He motored me round about 1,000,000 miles an hour. Me heart in me mouth, his hand up me skirt, and me mind on his meat and veg.
That must have been such great fun. Is that character a staple of British comedy, this blousy aging party girl? Give us your lips, you, and double me palpitations.
Give us your lips, you.
She's a staple of British life. I don't know. particularly in the north of England, they're very colourful characters in the north, and they're much more social beings. I love being in the north of England. They're really nice people, much more friendly. In fact, I was watching a documentary the other night on the television, and it was full of people like Mari. I think it's from Bradford or somewhere like that up north. Yes, people like her do exist. I have to say, if I saw her coming towards me down the street, I'd have to cross the road and she would frighten me. She's, yeah, but it was fun to play her, I must say, and it was fabulous working with Michael Caine and Jane Horrocks.
You wear some hideous outfits in this movie, I have to say.
All my own. Not really, I'm joking.
Is it tough to appear on screen in these tight, awful, knit clashing colors, slutty type things?
Yeah, Barbara, I'm often asked that. How do I feel when I see myself looking so awful? And my answer is, I don't see myself. I'm sitting here in the studio in London in an Armani suit. And
bless your soul.
I see her. I see Cynthia. I'm not playing me. I'm playing somebody else. And it's her problems I sympathise with. I think, oh, God, if you're your own worst enemy, Mari, don't wear those things. They look dreadful. Don't pull that belt in so tight. You'd probably look better if you didn't. Let the hem down, won't you? And leave those awful pantyhose alone. Yeah, I think the same as other people do watching it, because I don't see me at all. I see her, that sad, unfortunate, desperate person.
Michael Caine plays Ray in Little Voice.
Yeah.
He's also Mari's love interest. I think Michael Caine is just a wonderful actor, just the true professional. Had you ever worked with him before?
No, I hadn't worked with Michael Caine, and I have to say I was a little apprehensive when I turned up there to work with him, because he's so fabulous. I've grown up thinking what a wonderful actor he is, and here I am going to be playing these raunchy scenes with him. And I thought he might pull rank and want the focus of attention on him, and I would feel compromised. But not in the least. He was only concerned, as I was, with the scene working and not in pulling focus. If the scene works, it all works, and not with wanting the focus of attention on him at all. And we had the greatest respect for each other, and it was very, very enjoyable.
I think the first scene you filmed with Michael Caine, you had to leap on him and smother him with kisses.
Yes. Yes, it's the one where she runs out of the house and she leaps on him and kisses him. And yes, I think Mark Herman did that deliberately to sort of cut the ice a little for the more raunchier scenes later on.
Apparently
and
you kept
laughed a lot about it.
You kept messing up. You had to do it over and over and over.
Deliberately. Great.
Brenda Blethyn, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
It's totally my pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.
Brenda Blethyn. She plays Mrs. Van Pels in the new ABC miniseries Anne Frank. Part one airs Sunday night at 9. Coming up, we conclude our Avant-Garde Made Easy series with the music of Misha Mengelberg. This is Fresh Air. One point jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has emphasized in his series on jazz mavericks is that innovators don't deny the jazz tradition, but build on what came before them. The so-called avant-garde itself has had a profound influence on jazz and other music at home and abroad. By way of illustration, Kevin concludes his Avant-Garde Made Easy series with a profile of Dutch pianist and jazz and classical composer Misha Mengelberg. He frequently works with American improvisers, but Mengelberg's main vehicle is the nine-piece group known as ICP, the Instant Composers Pool Orchestra.
Misha Mengelberg began improvising and composing when he was very young. From the first, he had a gift for melody. The records he liked best were by Stravinsky and Ellington. You could dance to them. Stravinsky gave him an ear for funny-sounding chords, so when he heard Thelonious Monk in the early 50s, he got the point right away, especially how much fun you could have disguising very smart music as amateurish bumbling. You can hear Monk's influence on Mengelberg's first LP, Eric Dolphy's Last Date from 1964. That's from Misha Mengelberg's Hippochrismatree Fuzz. By then, he'd graduated from the Hague Conservatory and was composing for classical musicians and for jazz groups, but in very different styles. Then free jazz hit Europe and opened up a new world of possibility. Pianist Cecil Taylor's high energy and noisy harmony helped Mengelberg reconcile his abstract composing and boisterous jazz. But Misha's version was more playful. Misha Mengelberg with drummer Han Benink and German saxophonist Peter Brotzmann. All three were key players on the European free scene that emerged in the wake of the American one. Albert Eiler's composing was another catalyst. If a black saxophonist from Cleveland could write himself what sounded like Bavarian folk tunes, Europeans could also try on more continental material. They remade free jazz in their own image. Bars on tenor sax. Some commentators say European improvised music rejected jazz, but jazz's way of transforming American vernaculars from ragtime to show tunes was a guide to how the Euros might proceed. And Mengelberg, for one, has often revisited the music of old idols Ellington and Monk. The strings and jazz horns in Mengelberg's pocket orchestra, ICP, represent the composer's two musical worlds. He's also a great chess player who sees music as a game, the way improvising jazz licks to fit over chord changes is a game. In the 1960s, Mengelberg, like other classical composers, wrote game pieces. Instead of a score, musicians were given instructions how to react to or even challenge what someone else played. Later, Misha started using games and other compositional procedures in ICP, helping improvisers think like instant composers. He conducted improvising, as Sun Ra and others had, and showed his musicians how to stretch forms in various ways, or destroy them from within using what he calls viruses, or improvise their way up to a theme, not just away from it. Mengelberg's improvising informs his composing, too. A lot of catchy ICP tunes started out as melodies he invented on a gig. One fruitful source of material, a sort of musical chess game, is Mengelberg's duo with his alter ego, Han Benink, where each tries to subvert the other. That sort of willful intransigence carries over into Mengelberg's classical composing. An episode in his orchestra suite, Underway, conjures up Benink's stubborn percussion and Misha's anti-virtuoso one-finger piano. Improvisation was almost extinct in Western art music before jazz brought it back. Misha Mengelberg's work reminds us that the improvisational impulse jazz unleashed takes many forms, some far from obvious. His stuff offers yet more evidence that African-American music changed nearly everyone's sound in the 20th century. Think of it. Even Dutch composers play the blues.
Kevin Whitehead's Avant-Garde Made Easy series can be found on the Fresh Air website. Fresh Air's senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, modern dance pioneer Mark Morris. He's known for his groundbreaking choreography and his use of live musicians. The Mark Morris Dance Group is celebrating its 20th anniversary. This spring, the company is moving into its own studio space in Brooklyn, New York. Join us for the next Fresh Air.